I am the state engineer for the state of Utah. I'm the director of the Division of Water Rights. And I'm really glad that you came to be here at this public meeting that we've set up tonight. I really appreciate the Estill community and the high school here for providing this room. This is a great room for us to be able to meet in and have a community meeting to talk about some of the things that we're concerned about. My job as a state engineer is to regulate the use of water throughout the state. We've had some concerns expressed to us about water levels. We've actually just finished a hearing on a new application that we had before us by Prairie Farms and talked about some of the issues there, and some concerns were brought up and some positive things were brought up. There are just a lot of things that have come to my attention. I thought, you know what, we really need to come out here and talk about this. At the end of this meeting, I'm not going to tell you what we're going to do exactly here, but what I'm here to do is to gather your thoughts and opinions, because we need to work collectively as a community out here and as people involved in land administration and water regulation here. We need to be able to work together to come up and solve problems, to see problems, and then to solve problems as we try to address them here in this valley. I've been involved in years past in a lot of negotiations between the state of Nevada and the state of Utah, trying to work out how things are going to occur between even our two states, because we've got a shared groundwater basin here. You know, how do things work from state to state? Anything that Nevada does and makes statements about, they can't regulate what happens in Utah, and the same with Utah can't regulate what happens in Nevada. And there's actually been a congressional action that says if people are going to export water out of basins, they actually have to come up with an agreement on how water is going to be administered in those shared basins between states. And so we've had studies done. We've looked at different things about water availability. We've come up with some numbers that seem to be pretty big compared to what water use is occurring. But yet, I've had people from the local ranches call me and say, hey, our wells are going down. Our meadows are drying up. There's some real problems going on here. We need to establish a groundwater management plan, or we need to set some regulations so that we're not interfering with one another. We need to be careful about what's going on here. But yet, I look at some of the numbers, and I thought, something's not fitting right with me here, but it was a good discussion this last hearing about some of the things that are happening. But that's why I wanted you to be here, to help me make decisions about what we need to do and about my staff. I have some great staff here with me that we brought to the meeting. Our Deputy State Engineer Boyd Clayton is at the back of the room. He has a list, a sign-up list, that we'd like to have you sign up and give us a way to communicate with you, and we'll let you know as we go through this process what we're doing. We'll try to just keep everybody informed, because I want your input. I need your help. We need to make a collective decision about this. I have two assistant state engineers, James Greer, who's in charge of my technical services section and does a lot of the studies for us, and Teresa Wilhelmsen, who is our state hearing officer and in charge of our applications and records. Mike Drake is our regional engineer responsible for this area, and he's the one that gets to review all of the applications that come forth. He's the one that will come actually out to the field quite a bit and work with you to help solve problems. It's his responsibility to be here and look about what things are happening and see what's going. We have Chris York, who's going to be up here at the table, and he's going to be he's Teresa's assistant in our applications and records section. He's helping us keep a recording. We're going to record the proceedings tonight so we can come back and listen to them. And if you ever run out of things to do, some of you can actually go onto our website, and this will be posted on our website, and you can listen to it and go through some of the things that are said. And as we have future meetings, and I anticipate this won't be the only meeting we're going to have, Case, because we want to get your input before we make some final decisions and decide how restrictive or what kind of regulation we need to do in this valley, okay? We want your input for that. So what we've got this evening to present to you is we've got a PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to turn it over first to Mike, and then we're going to go to James to talk about some things. And then we want to turn the time over to you. Oh, thank you. Is that? Okay. Okay, so we've got a mic. That'll help here. Okay, but I'm hoping all of you can hear what's happening. Okay, but we want your input then, and If some of you have presentations and things, that's just fine. Or if you just want to make comments, or if you just want to listen to what we're saying, that's fine too. But the more ideas we have shared here, I think the better decision we're going to be able to come up with. But we've got some interesting facts and some interesting data that we've been able to pull together. And I know that Utah Geological Survey and the U.S. Geological Survey have both been working out here collecting data and gathering information and trying to determine what's happening with our groundwater system to give us better answers. So we're going to talk to you a little bit about what we're seeing, what we're finding out, and then we want your input on some ideas and suggestions. And we're going to give you an opportunity after the meeting to send in comments and just help us formulate what we need to do. And then we'll take this information from tonight, what you submit, and then we'll put that together and try to make some recommendations. And I anticipate we're going to come back out and meet with you and talk about some things that we need to do to help preserve the way of life here out in Snake Valley and preserve the economic interests and preserve the lifestyles that we want to have out here. And we need to be careful about what we do, realizing that there's a pretty good resource. But I'd like to turn the time over to Mike now. I don't know if any of you have any questions before we go further, but we'll just move into this presentation, and I'll turn the time over to Mike to talk to that.
Thank you. Let's make sure this works. Good. So I appreciate you guys coming out. Some of you I've had a chance to meet, a lot of you I haven't, and so it's nice to get the opportunity to meet all of you out here, and we've reviewed various proofs and applications to appropriate, and sometimes I don't always get a chance to put faces to names and corporations and farms, and so we appreciate that. So we don't have a long presentation, because we are here to listen more than anything. But we do want to present some things that we know. And it's going to start kind of at a high altitude sort of level initially. Okay, so Snake Valley is a very large basin, as you guys know. As we were evaluating this meeting, we looked and we saw and we compared the length of Snake Valley to the Wasatch Front, and it's pretty long, and we pile I don't know how many millions of people in that Wasatch Front area, and we can probably put two or three of them in the Snake Valley area. So today it's a very large basin, and so I recognize that when we talk about this high altitude view that Snake Valley is actually made up of multiple different areas, and so. So we're going to, as we work through the presentation, we're going to go from that high altitude view down to kind of a medium altitude view, and then ultimately, the ground level view I see is being provided by you guys. That's ultimately where we need to get. And so we're going to present what we know and what we see. We have record keeping responsibilities, and so we're going to present that. And that's what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to turn it over to James, who is going to narrow things down a little bit and show you what we're seeing in wells throughout the valley, and then we'll turn the time over to you guys to hear from you. So it's kind of what we're going to cover today: the current appropriation policy, where we are right now, and then I'm going to talk about how we're doing, and that's going to take a few different parts: that high altitude view, and then down to the medium view. We're going to look at the groundwater conditions throughout the valley, all right? And then we have this legitimate discussion. This is why we're here, is what are we going to do? And then we'll turn it over to you. All right, so the current appropriation policy is up here on the board. So the surface waters are considered fully appropriated. As you can imagine, for a desert valley, there aren't many surface sources, and those that there are appropriated, were appropriated years ago. Groundwater is limited to 550.05 acre feet, which is premised on 136 acres of irrigation, which is approximately a pivot, a full-size pivot, one house and 200 ELUs, or equivalent livestock units. And then the last provision of that is that applications are limited to one application per entity. And a new application can be filed upon receiving a certificate of beneficial use. Okay, so that's where we are right now. That's the framework we're working on. It was slightly modified in 2016, but yeah, for practical purposes, we've been operating like this for quite some time. It's a pretty large limit for the area, and so that's where we've been. So we want to know how this policy is working, and to try and understand that, we need to understand how much water is there, and then how much of this water is being used. And so that's what we're going to try and narrow down in these next few slides. And again, this is a high altitude view. So as we try and determine that, we review published literature, and maybe there's not a lot, but there is some literature on Snake Valley, and so we reviewed all of this, and some work that started back in the 1960s, and working through the 2000s. One of the important ones that we turn to is what's called the Barkus Report. And from this one, we get a safe yield for the basin. And again, this is the basin as a whole. And we come up with a safe yield, okay? And so these are some of the numbers that we have. And again, high altitude numbers that we have. And we have an estimated, from published reports that USGS puts out, we have estimated groundwater pumping in the valley of 20,300 acre feet of water. Okay, this does not include spring flows. So this doesn't include flows that are coming from fish springs, some of the other spring flows in the area. Okay, this is just groundwater pumping. So that number does need to be taken with a caveat there. From the Barkus report, we have a safe yield of 132,000 acre feet. Okay, and so with those numbers, we're going to jump into the water rights that we have. Okay, so we've reviewed the existing water rights. We've broken this out into perfected rights, approved applications, and unapproved applications. Okay, and we're including both what we call the 18 and the 19 areas. The 18 area is kind of the more northerly part, and then there is it's called, what's that? The 19 is the Hamblin Valley to the south. Okay. See, and I included those two numbers there. And again, so looking at this high altitude view, you can see that we have around 58,000 acre feet of perfected water rights on our records right now. Now, with that, we have 20,300 acre feet of groundwater pumping that's going on. Now, again, realizing that this doesn't include spring flows, these perfected rights. Estimated depletion does include those spring flows. But you can also see that those numbers, adding up all of them, are below the estimated safe yield in the basin, which is 132,000 acre feet. Okay, so again, this is to a degree a paper exercise, but this just shows you where we are. So the way we operate is the state law has us appropriate, and our mission is to place the waters of the state of Utah to beneficial use. And so we seek to keep that use below the safe yield. Okay, so these numbers right here are telling us that actual usage is likely significantly lower than 132,000 acre feet. And then even including perfected, approved, and unapproved applications, we're still somewhat lower. We're approaching that number. We're approaching 132,000, but there's still some way to go. Okay? Now, again, we're at high altitude, and now we're going to turn the time over to James to dig in a little bit more and look at some individual wells throughout the valley.
One thing you might want to point out, Mike, is we're talking about a safe yield estimate for the whole basin, Nevada,
and
Utah. This is just Utah's
use. Yeah, these are Utah rights only. Very good point.
That was what I was going to say.
There you go. Excellent. You guys are just as smart. Awesome. Okay.
So, yeah, my name is James Greer. I work in the technical services section of the water rights office. If you do have any questions, feel free to ask them as I'm going through this. I only have a few slides here, and we're going to talk about those slides. Just to reiterate what Mike has said, state law tells us that we are to manage groundwater systems on this safe yield basis, right? Other terms can be perennial yield or things such as that. What that means is we're going to look and see how much is recharging this groundwater system, how much is discharging out of this groundwater system. On an annual basis, how much water is essentially moving through this groundwater system? Groundwater moves very slowly, right? So it's not like it comes in and leaves in that year. But how much comes in every year, how much goes out every year from that system? And so we look at all those studies that Mike talked about, right? We have a list of some of the published studies, and there's been many studies since that list that we've talked about. The BLM at the hearing earlier talked about a study that was just published last week, I think, right? Is when it came out. And I've looked at it. I haven't had a lot of time yet to digest what's in that study, but we look at those to look at, okay, how much water is recharging this aquifer, right? And that comes through precipitation or return flows from irrigation or seepage from the streams or the canals that are coming into the valley, flowing down deep into this alluvial aquifer system. Or it could be subsurface inflow from another basin flowing into this area. And then that's really hard to measure, though. There's science out there that tries to estimate that, but it's very difficult. So there's a lot of uncertainty in these numbers, right? Another thing we do is we look at, okay, we've got to look at how much is going in, but how much is going out? And we look at ways to estimate what's discharging out of the aquifer, right? Is there water coming up into springs or seeps? A lot of the water here in Snake Valley, by the studies, has shown it's being used by native vegetation. It's that vegetation is pulling that water up out of the ground and evaporating it away as it processes to use through the area. There is the wells that are in the valley that are pumping that, and there's also some very large springs in a lot of the area that's discharging out of this system. And so we look at that and these studies to try to balance and come up with what we believe is annually available through this system to use for beneficial use. Mike already mentioned that large regional study that was done. When was it completed? 2007. There's been additional studies on top of that since then, but came up with some estimates of what that perennial yield is for the whole valley, that 132,000 acre feet. Okay, are there any questions about that before I move on? Okay, so, but really, one of the big key indicators for us as we look around the state are these water level measurements. We pay the USGS to do a study every year measuring water levels all around the state, including in Snake Valley. And so this monitoring well network helps us see what is going on in this area, in all the areas of the state. There is a special thing that's going on in Snake Valley. I see Hugh here from the Utah Geological Survey. What is it, 11 years ago now? 12 years ago?
2007-8.
They got a special appropriation from the legislature to set up a more extensive monitoring network in the valley. So we even have more wells than you would normally see in a lot of the valleys that we have, monitoring water levels, and additionally monitoring spring discharges throughout the valley. So we do actually have quite a bit of data. Mike did mention this is a very large valley. We always wish we had more data, but we do have quite a bit of data in this area. And we look at these water level measurements to kind of see what is going on. It's kind of our best indicator in an area of what is happening in that aquifer system. Okay? So I was just going to show water level measurements, and I just picked a few that I feel are good indicators throughout the valley. There are many more, and if we have questions or want to show, we can bring up the web and look at different ones as well. But I was just going to start, and this is going to be kind of small up here. We're starting at the very northern part of Area 18. Okay, this area here is Calio. Right here is Trout Creek. It's hard to see on this map, but these scales right here, this is 0 to minus 5, right? So when it's a negative, that means it's above the ground surface. These are depths to water level, right? And then you have, this is 0 to 5, this is 75, 80, 85. So as you look at these water levels we see here, you're seeing variations, you're seeing ups and downs, you're seeing most likely some climatic trends. In most of the state, you see here the 1980s. The early 80s were very wet. So a lot of times you'll see a bump in a lot of the water levels. Specifically, we see that in years where you have consecutive wet years. And that's what happened in the 1980s. In 2011, we had a very big wet year, just like the 1980s, but you didn't have consecutive ones. But we do see bumps, and even in 2011, it just depends on where you're at. You'll also see that a lot of times that those bumps are delayed a couple years from those wet years. Depending on where you're at in the aquifer and that response to that recharge, it could take a couple years to see that response from those wet years or dry years. Okay, so, but what we see here in the northern part of the valley, you can see there's fish springs right there, is when I look at those water levels, there's nothing there that's really concerning to me, right? I'm seeing kind of constant trends, maybe some ups and some downs, but generally they're pretty flat. Okay, so as we move down the valley, we're seeing some just general flat water levels that aren't going down. Okay? I've chosen some water levels here that have a longer period of record, and so I don't think I have any here from the UGS record, but some of those show similar trends as well. Okay? So now we're moving down the valley here. Trout Creek there. Gandy, right? Right there. Sorry, you can't see these very well. Estdale down here. So as we move down the valley, once again, we're kind of seeing some similar trends through this area. Water levels that are relatively flat. Okay. We're seeing some wells that you're seeing a lot of variation in, too. This is only 10 feet, so that's not a ton of variation. Water levels can go up and down climatically quite a bit from year to year. So down below Gandy here, and this area north of Estdale, you're starting to see, so this is 20 to 30 feet scale, and you're seeing some response to the wet 80s coming down here. Probably seeing this response to 2011, right there, right? Going up and down and around in these different areas. Okay, then we get to the Estdale area here, right? We have Garrison here, and I have another water level down here. So, you look at some of these water levels that we have around the areas here. Got a little more plotted on here. And near some of these pumping areas, right, we're seeing, here's the 80s. So maybe that's a little bit of incline. But here you're seeing some water levels that show some declining trends. I think it was brought up in the hearing, some of these water levels that we were talking about. Somewhere on the order of magnitude of maybe half a foot per year. It depends on which well you're looking at and some of those scales. And always depends on where you're starting from to where you're going. Some of these wells, let's see, like this one right here, you can see that it in the 80s, there looks to be a little bit of bump, and it comes down. And you see the 2011, maybe that was a little bit of bump that next year after. It'll be very interesting to look at some of the... So let me step back. The USGS on their wells, they go out and measure these wells every spring. In March, April, that general time frame. So we get one measurement a year. There are some wells that they measure more frequently, but out here, most of them are measured once a year. So the really wet winter we just had, depending on where you're at, could show up in a water level that was measured in March, but normally it would happen the year after in the next March, or even could be the year after that, depending on where you're at in the aquifer. Okay? So these water level measurements all stop at March of 2019, was the last measurement we're showing on these graphs. Okay? So we're seeing some downward trends. As you come down a little farther in the valley, the trends aren't as far down. Even down to here, you can see a downward trend, but the scale is pretty small, right? That's a couple of feet of downward trend over that 10 to 20 year period. Okay? You get down into the Garrison area, and these wells that I've seen in here as I looked at different ones, they have a much more climatic signature here. Usually what this means is these wells up here are probably more buffered from the annual variation. They're farther away from the recharge sources, like was mentioned earlier, or could be a variety of reasons, right? But when you see a well that looks more like this, it's probably an indicator that it's more closely tied, the recharge is closer, something's happened that causes it to be more closely related to the climatic signature than some of these wells that are up here near Estelle versus these wells near Garrison. But you can see in the 1980s, right, the early 1980s, after that you've got this rise in water levels, comes down, in 2011 time frame you see that rise and whatnot. Some of these rises as well could also be related to pumping. Right? I don't have when these wells are pumping or we're not. So you could, I don't know if this is the case, but you can see this rise right here. Right? Maybe that's because some of the pumping in that area wasn't happening those years previously, and you're seeing some rise from that. I'm not saying that's the case, but there's a lot of different things that can go into why these wells are going up and down. This water level here, even though from the 1980s we had a water level before the big wet years, about 70, maybe down there in the 80-foot range, it's dropped about 10 feet over a large time frame. That to me is not that concerning, because as you develop water, the idea is that you do draw down those water levels to help capture that annual perennial yield that's coming through the valley. That is the principle that we use as we develop this water for beneficial use. And then I just want to note down as we get farther down the valley, once again down here, we're seeing much level, flatter water levels as you go farther south, similar to what's happening up in the north. So in the north, the water levels are pretty flat. In the central area of Estelle, there are some downward trends, especially over the last 10 or so years. On the order of magnitude of half a foot per year. As you get farther south, we're not seeing those trends. Okay? So when I spoke earlier, our role is to help develop that resource or regulate the use of that resource to this safer perennial yield. We're going to use these water level measurements to show us, hey, have we reached that? Are we seeing water levels that would indicate that we're over that safe yield. And I kind of wanted to show a graphic here, I think it's the next one, of comparisons of areas where we are for sure we're over safe yield. I think Prairie Farms, you said, I can't remember your first name.
Patrick,
thank you, sorry. Came from the Rural Enterprise area. That is an area where we have a groundwater management plan where we feel like we're over safe yield. It's down here, west of Cedar City, and you can kind of see what's happening in these water levels. We look at these water levels and we see these downward trends of 2 feet per year or more. And we don't see any climatic signature of any change, really. You do see sometimes some little bumps, like you see that in 2011 right there in that well, or whatnot. But this is very concerning to me. And we see that sort of trend similar in Cedar City Valley, Parowan Valley, other valleys around the state. And we're actively working on groundwater management plans there to say, hey, we've done studies. The studies show that the amount of recharge and discharge in those valleys is less than the amount of pumping that's happening in those valleys. And we're working on plans to help bring those valleys back into balance. Okay? So when I look at these water levels here, especially in the north and the south, we're not seeing those similar trends. Now, this water level here, right, that comes from the Estill area, is that the beginning of this? And that's a very good question, right? Groundwater hydrology takes a long time. It's not something that you turn off your pumps and you see something just react very quickly. And so we want to continue to watch these sort of things to make sure we understand it correctly. We've had a very dry decade, right? So I don't know if that's the case, but that could be a result of the climatic. There's a lot of pumping that's going on around the Estill area. So it could be a result of that pumping. So those are the kind of things that we're looking at to help us determine what needs to happen in these areas. As a valley as a whole, this whole large valley, we do believe we're under the safe yield for the whole valley. We're only pumping about 20,000 acre feet, and the research shows there's 132,000. Now, large variations in those estimates, large uncertainty. So we want to be careful and do this right. And I think that's part of the reasons why we're having this meeting out here, to gather as much information as we can and need to help make decisions moving forward. But we wanted to share this information first to kind of give a baseline of what we're seeing. And then I think Kent was going to get up and ask for additional information from around. That's all I was going to show today. Are there any questions about any of the data or information that I've talked about so far today? Yes?
Do you have data on the draw from the Nevada? How much pumping is occurring in the Nevada side versus the Utah side?
Thank you. I do not have a good estimate of how much pumping is happening on the Nevada side, no. But that is something we should probably look into and look at getting a better estimate of. So most of our data comes from the Utah side. Questions?
What is the static water level of these wells in the valley?
What's the static water level? How deep are they? So as you're seeing here, let me go back. Most of these water levels are about 60 to 80 feet deep. They're 20 to 40. 20 to 30, it depends on which well you're looking at, right? These are monitoring wells, and it depends on where you're at. So if you see those scales, those are 20 to 30, 20 to 40, 20, 60 to 80 on these monitoring wells. That's from the surface down to the water level. The static water level. That sound about right to the most of the... Hey, are there any other questions? Okay. And if you have more questions, you're thinking, we'll be here after to answer and talk through anything. So, okay.
Okay. As Mike mentioned, the policy right now, because we looked at these trends about where we are and what's happening, the policy, we've kind of adopted the policy that let's approve some things, let them develop, see what the impacts are to the system, and kind of see how things equalize, and then we'll move to the next application. We had some people that came out and filed multiple applications all through the valley and wanted to tie up a whole bunch of water. We're just saying, we've got to be really careful here. We're not going to give all of the water to one person, but let's do this orderly. And so we've developed this policy to come in and do one application, let you get done with that, get it certificated, and see what the impact is, and then we'll move on to the next application. But we're hearing some things that we're even doing that's causing some problems in some areas. And so we're thinking, what do we need to do in those areas? And how do we get that information? How do we make those decisions? By statute, I can do a groundwater management plan in those basins that exceed safe yield. And we are working in several basins in the state right now to regulate those basins. And my authority is to regulate by priority. And so I look at those basins and I come back and say, okay, who was first in time? They get their water first, and we're going to go through priority of water rights. The junior ones that came in later, I have to start cutting them off until we get our basin stabilized. And that's the authority I have. It says I have to do that unless I can come up with some kind of voluntary arrangement with the people in the basin who want to come up with a plan about how they're going to stabilize that basin and how they're going to work together. So part of the reason for this meeting is that, you know, how are we going to work together? Because this is a community problem that we need to work on. But also my authority then, if we're exceeding safe yield, but as I look at the numbers, we are not exceeding the numbers safe yield in this valley. And so under statute, I really can't even come in and do that. So I have to come back and look at policy. And I'm thinking, so are there problem areas we're having? Do we need to stay away with some areas? Do we need to push development, spread it out more till we start approaching that? We do need to get a better handle on what Nevada is pumping, but I know as we went through those negotiations several years ago, it's like 80% of the pumping is occurring in Utah and 20% in Nevada. I mean, that's about 80% of the water is actually generated in Nevada, 20% in Utah, and the numbers are just switched, so the water basically falls there and comes into Utah to supply the basin. So there is pumping, we know, in Nevada. We know there are some problems that are associated with Nevada pumping and Utah pumping. There's some litigation, you know, that I'm aware of that's going on, how to resolve the localized interference problems. But as we look at the big numbers, things that have been approved, we're starting to approach limitations, but for actually pumping, we're not even close to what this valley can produce. But do we need to make decisions about where we actually approve those wells, where the water can be withdrawn? I know for many years as a state hearing officer, we've had some discussions out here. It comes to mind Needle Point Spring. We had some discussions about that and wells that were going in, and then all of a sudden the spring dries up and we've got a whole bunch of wildlife issues and stock watering issues about watering on springs that are starting to disappear. Do we want that to happen in the valley? And that was troubling to me, but now I see these drops that we're having are only just a few feet, and maybe we need to lower the land a little bit. I don't know. Because you know, the water was close. It dropped a little bit. There's some Supreme Court cases in Utah that kind of talk about people historically that have had flowing wells, and they want to have their flowing wells. Murray City comes in and puts a big well in Salt Lake Valley and starts pumping that well, and these flowing wells stop pumping. And the people are just ticked. You know, I'm entitled to where that water was. And that goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court comes back and says, you know what, you're not really entitled to that elevation of water. It says if you're going to have a flowing well, that means the aquifer's got to stay full and spilling. And to do that, nobody else can use the water. And we need to give people a reasonable opportunity to come in and take water and use it. So you might lose some pressure in those wells. We might have to see some declines in pressure so that we can share the resource and everybody can use that. But if we overuse it, then we're going to start dropping down. So the Supreme Court's giving us some direction on what we need to do about levels in wells and hydrostatic levels in the aquifer, that we understand if we take more water out, something's got to go down. But are we taking too much out that it's not ever going to stabilize? And so that's why we've been very cautious. Though what we're approving, that we still allow quite a bit of water. How many acre feet per application? 544, you know, is that too high? When I look at the numbers, that's probably not too high, as long as we're not causing localized interference. But I'm seeing reports of localized interference, too, so I need to be careful. So what I'd like to do is have a discussion about some of the things that you're seeing, some of the things you're concerned about, any recommendations you might have. Let's have a discussion about that, if that would be okay. Does anybody want to let me know what's happening out here, or what your thoughts are about what we ought to be doing and how we ought to adjust the policy, or do we just stay the same? You know, the BLM has made a suggestion to us about maybe some things that might help us, some of the things that they're very concerned about. We've got some endangered species issues out here, too, that if we start doing things that impact our ability to sustain them, there's some real problems on how we can actually use water in the state. And so we have to be careful about those kinds of things. But we're just looking about what an appropriate policy would be. So I know this is probably mostly uncomfortable to talk in a public meeting, but it is for me too. But if anybody else would like to speak and just tell me what your concerns are, what you're seeing, or what we ought to be aware of, let's get it on the record so we can think about that. And we'll also give you some more time to comment another time. So does anybody want to?
Could you have a state their name?
David Sterling. Yeah. In the past, there were a group of water rights that were given to CITWA. And that CITWA was the policy of perfecting a water right before it. Another one was granted. Was that in place at the time? Because it seemed like from the south of the valley all the way to the north, there were a whole bunch of water rights that were granted to CITWA during that time period.
And those water rights that were filed by CITWA were filed, but they were not approved. They are not approved water rights. So that's one of the reasons that we came back and said, what should the policy be at? Or should somebody come in and be able to file hundreds of acre feet or thousands of acre feet of water appropriations through the whole valley and tie that water up to the detriment of anybody else if they want to be using it, or to protect some of those issues that we have. So those applications were not approved. Portions of them have been approved. We developed the policy then based actually on after those applications came in, say we're not going to approve applications that cover all of what, yeah. And so we come back and say, you've got to have a critical need. If you don't have a critical need, we're not going to approve that. And if you have a critical need, you should put that water to use just as quickly as you can, get it certificated, and then if you need more water, then we'll approve another one. So that's the process that we've been going through. And so that has not, they are not approved, but they are still sitting there pending right now. Anybody else?
I'll come back in a second. This is Patrick. But on those water rights, how come they haven't been rejected then? Why are they pending for 10 or 15 years with school trust land? Why have you not rejected them water rights then?
Okay. Why have we not rejected them? Policy actually would have allowed them, but I didn't think it was in the best public interest to do that. And so we've gone through a process of adopting our policy about what we will approve. So they're just sitting out there, but we have not taken action. I do have a recommendation before me to take action on those, that we ought to clean all of that up and just not have them pending anymore. But that has not been done yet. So why? It's just because we haven't taken action on them yet under our existing policy.
I'm Kate Holcomb. I'm a native aquatics biologist with the Division of Wildlife Resources in Utah. And I just wanted to take some time to provide some information about some of the groundwater-dependent wildlife that live throughout the Snake Valley. Native snails and mussels of this area live in springs, ponds, and wetlands, which are maintained by groundwater. Excessive withdrawals of groundwater could reduce spring flows and thus reduce the size or quality of these critical habitats. Although many snails and mussels often go unnoticed, they play important roles in the environment. They filter water, cycle nutrients, and provide food to other animals. Unfortunately, snails and mussels are among the most highly imperiled animals in the United States. There are approximately 139 species of mollusks, meaning snails, clams, mussels, and slugs, in Utah, and at least 79 of them, which is about 50%, are considered imperiled. Many of these imperiled mollusks are threatened by water issues, invasive species, and habitat disruption. Eight mollusk species of concern are found in the Snake Valley area, and they include one mussel, winged floater, and seven snails, which are the bifid duct perch, cloaked bisa, desert trionia, Hamlet Valley perch, longitudinal gland perch, subglobose snake perch, and Utah bisa. Each of these species is on Utah's sensitive species list, and currently a federal species status assessment is underway for three of the species, the Hamlet Valley, longitudinal gland, and subglobose snake perchs. And that's to determine whether federal protection is needed under the Endangered Species Act. Spring habitats are critical to the survival of these eight mollusks. Several of them are only found in a few locations in the Snake Valley and nowhere else in the world. Therefore, impacts to the springs in the Snake Valley due to groundwater withdrawals could have a serious negative impact on the viability and long-term persistence of these species, which could contribute to a listing under the Endangered Species Act. And that outcome would not be in the public interest. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for that. Could you comment, if these things do go on the endangered species list, what does that mean? Do you have a feel for that?
I think it would depend on what species and where they live, but there certainly would be some economic impacts, especially related to water issues. But considering that the three species that I mentioned there
thank you. I know in other areas of the state when we're dealing with endangered species lists, I mean, millions of dollars are being spent to try to get them recovered, and water rights are being restricted about how we can use water even in order to be able to bring these things back and stabilize them. I know on the Green River that we're dealing with some fish species there that we're trying to do with, and then it seems like we put sports fisheries in that eat all of the endangered. So we're trying to deal with all of those problems about how to do that, but I know there's some problems with that, that it's created an economic problem out there in that system.
I just also wanted to mention that I have additional information about that you provide or send the information.
Okay, thank you. And we'd like to have that too. That would be good to go for the record. When we start talking about mussels, it just thought came whether Lake Mel has a whole bunch of them. I'm happy to share them with anyone.
Do not bring mussels.
You know, people are pretty concerned about them moving throughout the state.
I'm Hugh Hurlow with the Utah Geological Survey. So I just had a quick statement and then a question that relates to what Katie's talking about. So 10 years ago, the U.S. Geological Survey did a valley-wide survey of water levels, and we're planning to redo that this coming spring. So just if any of you are well owners and you see us zipping around, knocking on your door, that's kind of what we're up to. So there could be a bunch of us next February, March, just trying to see what the changes over a 10-year period are throughout the valley. We're going to try for really wide coverage, much more than we established. So just to let you know that. So my question then is, for springs administered as groundwater or surface water in the sense of their flow is kept track of, and is the drying up of a spring regarded in the same way as the lowering of a water level in a well? Or
so, Nathan, I know you're an attorney. Do you want to?
I'm going to defer to you.
Okay. Historically, the state engineer's office has always administered springs as surface water flow. Okay, that's a surface water discharge, and that's a surface water as a stream, and that's how they're treated. Unless you go into a spring and develop that spring and develop additional groundwater and increase the flow of that spring, then you can have combinations of surface water and groundwater at the stream source. It gets complicated. Yeah, and so how does that make a difference? So if you went and developed a spring, you've got groundwater, and then you have a well pumping, that portion of the spring that gets impacted could be considered in a groundwater management plan, but we do not consider springs, as part of that. But we do look at them. I know in Cache Valley, we did a study up there. They're not exceeding safe yield, but they have a lot of water. But as you develop water there, actually, every acre foot you take out of the groundwater, it affects the bare river flow that's going downstream to the downstream users, which is a fully appropriated stream. So we've got a lot of groundwater, but it impacts the stream. So we've come back on our groundwater management plan that if you're pumping groundwater, and we can show this directly tied to that surface source, then we've actually put some restrictions, and the people have to come back and then show what they're depleting from the system, buy additional water rights, and let those water rights go to downstream to satisfy those downstream surface sources. And so we've done it in some areas to try to protect those few, but it's normally they're not considered in a groundwater management plan. Boyd, I don't know if you had anything else on that.
The statute does allow us to conjunctively develop plans to conjunctively administer groundwater and surface water, and that's the way.
So in that conjunctive, and we have done that in some areas, we've looked at that, but they are considered different sources. But if we go into a conjunctive management plan, then we can regulate them as the same, and we have done that in some areas. Okay?
So Kent, on his question about if stream flows, springs are being impacted by, the question on the strings are being impacted by groundwater pumping. I know in certain areas of the state, right, we've looked at it and said, hey, if the spring is being impacted, you are allowed to develop groundwater in replacement for that spring, correct?
Yes, we have allowed that, and that would be through a change application process, but we do allow surface water rights to be converted to groundwater rights. You can file a change to do that and move those rights through a change application process. So we have allowed that, and in our Cache Valley policy, it specifically states you can, if you've got springs that you've lost from groundwater development, you can come back and file a change, but you've got to drill a well, in which people with springs are a little angry. Why should we do that? And the reason we do that is because there's so much water that's available that could be used that can't be used if those sources have to be maintained. And so it's that we've got to come to a best balance in public interest on how we use that resource and how it all works together. So we that's what we've done in those areas. And if I had a spring and had to drill a well and start pumping a well, I don't know that I'd be overly happy about it. That's why I didn't drill a well or a spring.
My name's John Hansen. I'm still not clear on your spring thing there, because if right now in the valley, if you file an application for water, the BLM is the biggest opponent to that, and their biggest complaint is you're drying up all the springs. And some of the springs are just a little mudhole, so I'm a little fuzzy on whether or not the drying up the springs is a concern or not a concern.
And anytime somebody brings a concern to us, it's always a concern to us, okay? But we have to decide what's in the best public interest. If we allow groundwater development and the spring dries up, what alternatives do we have? And we have allowed people that with springs, as we've stated, to go ahead and put a well in and supply that source from if you can show that you've been impaired. Now, statute says that we should approve rights if, subject to prior rights, and that it should not be able to cause impairment to those rights, okay? And if your right has been impaired by somebody else, you are absolutely authorized under statute to get compensation for that impairment, but the state engineer can't make that decision. That's a decision that has to be made by the courts. And so that puts a burden back on the impaired party then to take the person that they think is impairing them to court and get the court to decide if there actually is impairment. The burden to show the impairment is on the impaired party. They have to show that they've been impaired and who's done it. So they would, you know, if you put in a well, a spring dries up, the spring owner says, hey, there's an impairment, and that's an unreasonable thing. That case I talked to you about with Murray City, it was Wayman versus Murray City. They went back and said, there, you have to expect a reasonable reduction. I don't know. Okay, but the courts are going to have to decide what reasonable is. We've taken a position that you can develop groundwater and use that up, and perhaps a spring. We'll give the spring owners an opportunity to develop that water, to go to groundwater, recover their source. But if we approve that, we think that there's an opportunity to use additional water in the basin that people ought to be afforded the opportunity to develop that water and use it, even if it's going to dry up the spring. And that's kind of the position we've taken in the past. So, but there are some issues, and we had some comments here about what does that do if we start drawing up all these what things, and we've got these mollusks and mussels and other listed animal species that we start drying all those up, and then directives come back through the Endangered Species Act that you have to protect those or recover those, and we then may have to start curtailing water use, or we may have to get some kind of solutions or work together and come up with a plan, or we may not be able to develop or even use water. In the valley, so we've got to be careful about that. We've got to be sensitive to those issues. So I don't know if that even helps. Did I skirt it well enough so that you still won't know? But I talked long enough to retire and listen. Okay, but it's a tough issue. Yeah. It's tough. But we have gone ahead and approved those kind of wells to allow development. But the other thing, we're trying to protect and be sensitive to these other issues as best we can. But then I look at the numbers too, and it says 32,000 acre feet of water, and we're only using 20 something thousand, and potentially we're only going to use about 90. Where are we? But there's a discussion about maybe there's some localized channels in this groundwater that maybe all of the water can't be taken out of one location. You start pumping there, and we can't get all 132,000 out of one location. Maybe it needs to be spread out. Maybe we've got localized or pocketed areas where our groundwater is moving. We don't have enough information. You and company are going to help us identify that. You've been doing some great work out here. And I know the legislature, I think, is giving you some additional money this year. It seems like they renewed some funding.
The same
money, not new money, but continuing on. So the legislature is even concerned about here. And I know they have been since the days that we were involved with negotiations with Nevada to try to protect Utah water rights, to make sure that Utah gets to keep the water that they have here. And also realizing we're in a shared basin, but the Utah Geological Survey has been assigned the responsibility to kind of come out here and monitor this and give us some good input and keep the data recorded. So we appreciate what you and people are doing out here. So. Okay, other questions, comments?
My name is Eric Correa. I live in Baker. So part of my business is in Utah. And first off, I want to thank you for coming out here. I really appreciate the fact that the state auditor would come out to this area and talk. I don't think you can get the Nevada state auditor to come to Baker for such a meeting. I think that's great. I think along those lines, I believe that it's important. They serve on the White Pine County Water Advisory Board, and that you do get local input. Talk to people about what they think, what they're concerned about on the local levels. So I appreciate this meeting. Along those lines, when you state that there's 132,000 acre feet of safe yield in these basins, I know for me it makes me nervous because I see all the what's happening now during the drought. And I appreciate the fact that you're moving slow. I would hope that you would continue to do that, you know, slowing your decision making and to see how the drawdowns do, you know, as they happen in the future. One of the things that we're in Whitman County and what everybody's more we're pushing for is a Largus II study. And whatever support that Utah could help, that would be great. I know when Largus first came out, it wasn't any, didn't have any new information. We just gathered all the information that was available at the time and coming up with their best conclusions. But given that time since 2007, we know that some of those conclusions were wrong and that maybe it's time for a second Largus study to, based on what new information there is now, and be able to come up with some modeling and some better conclusions.
And I'm totally of the opinion, the more data we have, the better decisions we can make. So, and then that's part of why we wanted to come here and just start these discussions. Help us, okay? And let's get some information. Let's get better information to make better decisions. And that's, I just think that's so important. So, other comments? Is anybody from the Nevada State Engineer's Office here? You want to identify yourself? Actually, they were invited to come. We wanted to let them know we were meeting, but I know they are involved in some pretty serious water right hearings going on this week and next week, I think, from what I've heard. So, but, and in the past, I know Jason King with a past state engineer over there made a decision on a change application for some points of diversion that he did not approve some of points of diversion on the change application because he felt like it was going to impair rights in Utah, which I thought, that's a great, and Jason and I, we met quite a bit. He retired this last year, but we'd meet at least once a year, sometimes more, in some meetings that we go to, and I just thank you for making that decision. So there is some sensitivity, but there's not a lot of responsibility over that state line either, so. So there's some problems that we're trying to work through. So, anyone else want to make a comment? Yes.
So I'm Mike Gates with the Bureau of Land Management, and I manage the local office in Fillmore. And we've just to address one of the comments here about why does the BLM protest my water right? And I know that many of you have been frustrated by that in the past. One of the things that we want to point out, and I'm going to turn some time over to Roy Smith from our Denver office, he helps us out immensely with this, is that we see some indicators that concern us. And some of it goes to some of the concerns with the springs that we talked about. Although, you know, the state of Utah has an opinion on that. We still are obligated for the public interest to protect those springs for wildlife. It's also, you know, us as BLM, we don't use those water. That water is held in public trust and public interest for wildlife. It's held for recreation uses and also for livestock grazing, most importantly. So those among you that have livestock grazing, that water is life critical for those allotments to have water. And some of those springs provide just really cheap and easy access water for livestock grazing. And so it's in our interest to protect those. And that's why some of you have seen a protest in the past from us, and we're going to continue to do that because we feel like there's some indicators there that I'll let Roy talk about. But I grew up in Miller County. I'm from Holden. I live in Holden. I've lived there for a long time. We have a good track record of working with you as you come in and need rights-of-ways. And those of you who have livestock grazing permits, I think we try to work hard to make sure your cattle get turned out and you're able to use the land. And for recreation, I think we're very open to recreation and all those things. So this is just one place where we feel it's our obligation to just raise the awareness on it and make sure that we're trying to do our part there. I'll turn some time to Roy and go over some of the data.
Hi, my name is Roy Smith. I'm the statewide water rights coordinator for the BLM in Utah. And I've had the good fortune to spend quite a bit of time in Snake Valley looking at some of your hydrologic resources. And I was on the team that represented BLM Utah in the SNWA EIS process and learned a lot about the valley that way. One of the things that Kent mentioned is that BLM has given some ideas to the Utah Division of Water Rights about things that they might want to consider. And I want to explain a little bit more some of those ideas so that you can think about them. And the reason that we propose these ideas is that BLM is in a unique position. We understand the state engineer's legal mandate that he is supposed to facilitate beneficial use of water in Utah. We're in the land management business, and we're supposed to continue to provide multiple use benefits from BLM lands. And we have a particular problem with springs, because some of the alternatives that might be available to farmers and others that have a different sort of economic activity are not available to the BLM. For example, with sensitive and endangered species, we cannot replace the flow of that spring with a well. There's diverse habitat and diverse depths of water, diverse substrate types around a spring, and we just can't replicate that with the well. So we can't really implement that solution for sensitive species. The other thing you might notice is that our springs are in really far-flung locations. So it's not easy at all for us to replace a spring with a well, because those locations don't have an electric line supplying power that we can readily use. And our alternative would be to dig a well and pump it with diesel power, which requires a lot of personnel time and a lot of maintenance. And so what we're trying to do is to try to work with the state engineer's office to offer them ideas about how we can continue to use water in Snake Valley while maintaining that balance and maintaining some of those springs and the wells that are important to us additionally. I mean, we get it that sometimes the water level in wells goes down, and in and around Estale we have redeveloped some of our wells to lower the pumps in them or to put pumps in wells that were previously free-flowing. So we're willing to do that, but we're especially concerned about the long-term viability of those wells and the long-term viability of our springs. And so I just wanted to give you some ideas to chew on here. This is just a restatement of the policy that Kent Jones has to follow. Can allow new center pivots up to 136 acres, about 544 acre feet of water. And once you certificate one completed center pivot, you can apply for another. So I want to show you what's kind of happened under that policy. And this is two aerial photos taken 10 years apart, 2006 and 2016. And what you see happening is under this policy, there's not a giant amount of new development, but there's enough new development that's happened under that policy to make a difference. There's about, in this area here, there was about 7 new center pivots authorized. There's about 3 down here. And then what you can't see off the map is what's happened in Nevada. And there was about 4 new center pivots authorized there. And when you think about most center pivots use somewhere around 400, 500, 600 acre feet of water annually, in a 10-year period, there's about 7,000 acre feet of new pumping in this vicinity. And in that time period is when we started noticing that springs were blinking out and that our well levels were going down. And so we think that we might be hitting the point where we're exceeding the ability of this aquifer to recharge itself. And the reason that we say that is when you look at the well levels that James put up on the screen, they're a steady downward decline, and you're not seeing big variations from year to year that might respond to drought or to big snowpack years. And that's because we agree with what James is saying, is that that recharge is probably from a very distant location, and it just flows into the Estale area very slowly at a steady rate year after year. And what we're concerned is that steady rate is now starting to be exceeded. So one of the things that we've asked him to think about is that this area that we've got up here is part of a localized flow system. You know, you can't build enough wells in and around Estale to get 132,000 acre feet out of Snake Valley. This is part of a recharge system that's constrained geologically, and there's only so much water available in this portion of the system. So we've asked Kent to think about breaking up this area into different sub-areas, and those different sub-areas would have different policies on how much groundwater development would be allowed overall. And it might be different up in Calio, where the groundwater levels appear to be fairly stable, and that might be a more restrictive policy here around Estale, where we're seeing what we fear is the early end of a, you know, of a groundwater level that looks like the Barrel Enterprise area. So it's just an idea that we've offered to Kent's office to think about. And we really appreciate what Kent's office has been doing since 2016. They have been very cautious. There's only been 243 feet of new pumping approved in the last, you know, 3 years. That's pretty slow going. But the way that the policy works is it really doesn't allow Kent to take a look at an individual application and say that application by itself creates impairment, I'm going to deny it, because the average new well that goes in might decrease groundwater levels overall by 1 to 2 feet. And 1 to 2 feet on a neighboring well is not necessarily considered impairment. But when you look at all of the pumping in all of the wells in this whole area, collectively, you start getting what BLM believes is impairment, and our springs dry up and our well levels are going down. So right now, Ken really doesn't have a tool that enables him to say no to individual applications very easily. It takes a lot more analysis and legal work for him to do that. So what we've suggested is taking a more aggregate approach to this part of Snake Valley, where you, when you're looking at new groundwater development, you say, what is all of the groundwater pumping in the hole doing right now to the well levels in the area, to the spring flow, get that baseline, and then add the impact for a new application on top of it, and put those two together and see if there's going to be impairment. So we're asking Kent just to take the bigger picture view rather than just looking at individual applications. So we're recommending that that Kent's office consider a policy change that would implement those individual sub-areas that I talked about. We've asked also Kent to think about a groundwater management plan, and Kent would have to speak to the legal authority of it, but I believe, is it true that if the residents of a basin request a groundwater management plan, that you can adopt one even if you were below safe yield?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's just something that we're just putting out there as an idea for the water users in this area to think about. And we think while all this discussion's going on, you know, we're asking Kent to deny new applications, go very slow, and continuing monitoring those critical sources, especially the ones that are on the springs. But from the BLM perspective, is we're trying to manage those springs, but in the big picture, we use only a little tiny bit of the water in the valley. It's the if there's going to be a new policy and a groundwater management plan, all the people in this room who are groundwater users have to be comfortable with it and have to live with it, because that's where the bulk of the water is being used. So we're suggesting this as an idea, not trying to say, you know, we want to impose this on everybody. We're just saying we need some ideas about how to proceed differently, and we're trying to provide them. Yep.
So just to follow up, Roy, the BLM has no policy and no direction. So we're against water and usage of water. We just see something that's out there that we need to address, or we want to alert you all to it. I think Roy uses it as fly the canary in the mine. That's what we feel like we're doing. And finally, we want to participate in whatever process is done. So we'll summarize that completely, and we'll be here to participate.
Thanks for those comments. And we have talked about this, and that's an important concept to share, and maybe an option we want to look at. I don't know if you want to share that map.
Just sure, if you want to put it up, we can take a look.
I think it's on there somewhere, right?
It's on the back end of ours.
Yeah, but it was just an interesting proposal about some areas that maybe we ought to be looking at in the valley, where we ought to be a little bit more restricted than other areas, where we might have these localized flow systems coming through the valley that we ought to be very careful with.
That's hard. So we provided this map to Kent as just an idea for his staff to work with. And the way we developed this is I worked with our hydrologist on staff in BLM, and we took a close look at the geologic maps and the hydrologic studies that have been done in Snake Valley. And it looks like you can sort of divide the valley geologically and hydrogeologically into these 3 years. Now, we can't do anything in Nevada in this room because they're operating under a different state and different authority. But what we're saying is this, the Garrison Estale seems to be sort of one concrete part of the local flow system that you might want to manage separately, given the well drawdowns that James put up that sort of had this steady downward trend. And then you have another area up here that's the Gandy Partoon area, where levels have started to maybe decline a little bit, but they're still fairly stable. But in this particular sub-area, that is ground zero for a lot of the sensitive species that we have, the snails, the sensitive fishes. So we're suggesting that there needs to be great care taken in that area just because of all of the sensitive species in the springs. But then you have this other vast area of Snake Valley where there hasn't been much groundwater development and where you might be able to develop some of that 132,000 acre feet without having, much impairment going on and much impact to sensitive species. So it's just kind of a theoretical way of dividing this area into sub-areas for administrative purposes. And those lines could certainly be moved, but they were just kind of based on geologic compartments of the valley that seemed to be somewhat self-contained. And just one more point I want to make. I think Prairie Farms mentioned that the flow in this system, the overall flow in the system at the very, very deep level is from south to north. But a lot of what is the problem is that's in the carbonate aquifer system, and a lot of the problem is in the shallow aquifer system, the valley fill aquifer. And so these units are based more on the valley fill system and how it's broken up into compartments.
And that may be a more west to east flow and then turning north?
Yes, correct. Yeah. Yeah, if you, I think Utah Geological Survey put out a study and suggested that in this part of the world that we're sitting in, recharge occurs up in here and it kind of goes from west to east and then north. Is that correct to you? Okay.
Okay, so an interesting suggestion to think about, and we'd like to have people comment on that and just see, does that make a lot of sense? And as it was presented, I said, well, that's... Maybe that's what we need to be careful with. But some of those critical areas we have to look at is where most of the development is occurring here, too, and people don't want it to develop. And so do we shut that off? But we've got such critical issues that we have to address, and it makes sense. But we want to hear from you on that and about how what we should do in those areas. And if this, something like this makes sense, and maybe it's a modified area. This isn't a set in stone boundary, but it's a suggested area that maybe we need to be real sensitive about those things that we need to watch. But then would still leave us several areas open that where things could be developed if you can find water in those areas. Yeah.
Earl Rawlings, I live in the Trout Creek area. Some of us were just wondering, with the extra water, the aquifer that's available hasn't been appropriated yet, if we have a mirror image of SNWA, Southern Nevada Water Authority, being formed in the local communities or local governments along the Wasatch Front with their exponential growth, demand for water is going to also grow with that exponential growth. And we have unappropriated water that just has to be beckoning to some millionaire developer that wants a few more million.
That's a great suggestion. Oh, you're not saying they should do that. And yeah, I mean, anytime there's inappropriate water on our list, there are people interested in it, and they're starting to reach out further and further. We've just finished about 4 years of litigation and 7 other years of consideration on Central Iron County Water Conservancy District going into Western Beaver County and developing water. They haven't developed it yet, but they filed for water there to bring that back in through about an 80 or 90 mile pipeline, which will go across a lot of public land that they're going to have to get permits for that. But they're talking about bringing that water, so that people are starting to reach out further west. If you've got wells in a development system in 101 Pine Valley, it's just one more mountain range to Snake, right? To get over, well, you got to the valley and then Snake Valley. But yeah, I mean, that's something to think about. But my responsibility as state engineer is to put the waters of the state to their most beneficial use. And if people ask for it, we feel like that there's reason to believe that we can put water to use without impairing the rights of others. My obligation under statute is to do it, give people the opportunity. So you can't hurt anybody when you do this. You can't impair their rights. But I'm supposed to give them the opportunity to do that. And if those decisions cause problems, then we end up in court to try to get that resolved. And there's some issues coming out here that some things, Roy mentioned that replacing with well water doesn't work in these spring areas that we need to help protect these sensitive species. And so if that happens, I tend to go drill a well and it doesn't work. And we've got some real problems. So it's better to address these things up front and make sure that we've got some protection. So yeah, there's some tough things to consider.
The large area that was on the map that was undeveloped is also part of the Utah testing and training range. How does that affect the decisions of the state engineer with the UTTR out here?
Having been out here some days when they've been doing their bombing runs, I just kind of keep my head down. Fly pretty low. Now, holy cow. Our decisions are not based on who flies over. They're really not even based on who controls the land. It's based on, is there unappropriated water? And if there is, we will make those decisions according to them. Then we leave it up to the applicant to work out easements and access and ability to develop. It's kind of like a fishing license. We'll give you a license to go develop the water. You have to find a way to do it. If you can't do it, you can't work things out. If you can't get easements or access, then the water generally will just go away if you can't develop it. So every so often, we also will approve it, and we'll say, okay, you got to get it done. And you have to be diligent or have a reasonable cause for delay. And if you can't show that you're being diligent or have a reasonable cause for delay, or somebody won't let you do it, then we will just deny the extension request on the time when you have to submit proof. So, okay. Other comments or suggestions anybody has?
My name is Kevin Wheeler. I'm with the Utah Division of Wildlife. I'll back up what Kate and Roy are saying about sensitive species, especially those that are dependent on the springs and the habitats here. I've worked in Snake Valley for 20 years now, studying the Columbia spotted frog and least chub. Both those species have been petitioned multiple times to be listed as endangered species. And because we were able to work out conservation agreements and do actions on the ground to help save those species, we've kept them off the list. But obviously, if the springs go dry, those species aren't going to have anywhere to go. Particularly with the least chub, there's only 6 populations that are natural that are left in the world, all in Utah. 3 of those are in Snake Valley, so it's a precarious situation for them. And I just want to encourage you to work with that. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm thinking of the day we were up north at Wendover and looking at some of the water rights for Wendover City, and they had a pipeline that comes down. The pipeline actually had a break in it, and the water was flowing downhill, and there's fault forming a pond in a gravel pit area up there. We drove up to see what the problem was, and we saw the water start to shimmer. And then, what is going on? We got out and looked at that. That water was just chock full of tens of thousands of spotted frog tadpoles.
And there's this like, so what do you mean these are?
All they need is water, right? And it was just from a leak in the pipe. How did they even get in there? But,
and I'm sure that eagles were flying around or other birds, you know, were just waiting for dinner to come in. But it was just amazing how many there were, and that if the resources kept and available, that there are some things that I think could help restore, but we need to be careful. I'm guessing later on in the summer they fixed that hole, and you know, we lost a whole bunch of potential animals that could have been saved. But that was just incredible to see that. It was just like the whole thing was just tadpoles making waves on the water. But I had this thing, oh, what do you mean? These guys are almost gone. They're all over the place. But a few weeks later, they probably were. Okay. Other comments?
I just had a quick question. Could you kind of address domestic whales in your decision making and how that ties into the future?
Okay, as far as domestic whales, everything in the state of Utah, it says that all waters above and below ground are state waters. They belong to the public and are available for appropriation. We regulate that. Some states don't regulate domestic use. You can just put a home in and drill a well. But in Utah, for a home well, you have to come through the state engineer's office and get approval for that. Normally, in areas where we see expansive areas, we've kind of left those areas open for home use to be able to approve wells. We've got the Colorado River Basin, which is really over-appropriated. On paper, we still allow domestic, but so people want to come in and build a home, we will give them appropriations through that. My guess is, you know, we want to look at this in Snake Valley, do we want to do that? You know, if we develop a policy and we're going to get more restrictive and not allow larger acres in some areas, would we still allow small wells? Small wells don't take much water, but 1,000 small wells impact. The state of Montana, we met with them talking about domestic wells. They don't regulate domestic wells, but they're starting to see problems in some of their river systems now. All of the homes that are on wells, they're all pumping, and they're seeing diminished flows in their stream flows. Some people blame it on climatic changes, but if you look at the thousands of acre feet they're taking out just by these homes, and the rivers are starting to be impacted by them. We need to fix that. I just smiled, so we don't have that problem, because we regulate all of the domestic wells, but we would want to look at that. Do we want to allow those kinds of, if we get restrictive here, do we want to allow them? And I'm of the opinion that someone would like to move out here and have a home, they probably ought to have the right to be able to do that. But that's something that we can talk about and we need to consider. Some areas are closed to domestic appropriations in the state because we know we're over-appropriated, we've got groundwater declines. If you want to build a home, you actually have to go buy a water right from somebody and file a change application on that to put a well in just to do a home. So it depends on how restrictive we want to get out here, too, if we're going to get that restrictive. But, so it's just different in each part of the state. And I'm generally very supportive of people, if they want to have a home and be able to develop that to live, they should have that right to do it. But some places they've got to go buy water and have a chance to do it. Okay?
Hello, I'm Ben Roberts of the National Park Service. I work at Great Basin National Park, which is in Nevada, which is close. Let you all know, we do support a groundwater management plan, have that based on the best available science. And right now I would point out that Roy mentioned that the best available science right now is a new USGS report that just came out 2 weeks ago. It talks about resources, federal resources mostly, but it's a model of the Snake Valley. They looked at almost 50 springs and wells in the public interest, and that report shows that there are current and future groundwater declines throughout the Snake Valley, Utah and Nevada. That given just the current irrigation, so this is just the current approved rights, not all of which have been developed yet, but the current rights show that among those sites, that there will be between 0 and 123 foot of drawdown, which, you know, if you're close to the zero, which is closer to the Snake range, you're looking pretty good out here in the valley where it could be 132 foot. That's problematic. If you add on what they consider the minimum of 35,000 acre feet of drawdown in Nevada, based on the SNWA water rights, you get between 0 and 2,002 acre feet of drawdown. So this is a steady state model, and the modelers here can tell you exactly what that means. But if those rights, whether it's SNWA or anybody else, that 35,000 foot of drawdown, I don't think there's anybody here that wants to see 2,000 foot go down. So anyway, that is USGS Open File Reports 2019-1083.
And we are aware of that report, and we're looking at that now. And I start having 2,000 feet of decline. I know we've had 200 feet of decline in Burl Enterprise area, and the land doesn't like that. When you take all the water out, it does this. It compresses, and we've had some land fissures there. We've had some dropped roads broken apart, and it's also happened in Cedar City Valley around the Enoch area. They've actually roads have dropped down because so much water's been taken out. So we want to be sensitive to that, and that's why we're in there now saying, hey, this has got to stop. And so we've got a system, we've got a meeting here coming up in another couple of weeks in the Cedar City where we're going to go and establish a plan and say, here's the priority, here's how we're going to start cutting, unless you come up with a voluntary plan to help solve this problem, which they are working on. We've got a Citizens Advisory Committee that's formed in Cedar City Valley, and they're working on getting water back into the groundwater system through recharge and other products. So there's some things to get resolved that, you know, it's a difficult thing, and it's taken over 70 or 80 years to kind of see this thing develop and the land start to subside. And so we're trying to fix that, and it's going to take a number of years to get it stabilized, but it's a problem. We have to come back in and do that. And if we do something like that, then what happens to the springs and what happens to the species we're trying to watch over? And I'm also of the opinion one of the endangered species out here is the people that live here. So we need to be very careful to help protect them and the lifestyles out here. And so we've got to come to a balance here, and that's why I thought let's have a meeting. Let's talk about this. Let's get things going. It's going to take a little bit to kind of work through this. It's going to take some time, but I think this is a good thing for us to do. Craig, I don't know if there's anything that you want about the Baker Ranches or concerns that you guys have.
We're just concerned about the water levels in various areas of the valley. The 132,000 acre feet doesn't do much if you're in an area that there's decline. And it doesn't take much decline if you're right next to a spring. So I think... that you should be careful with new appropriations.
What are you seeing happening to your farm fields and meadows or anything associated? Anything that is causing you concern?
There's drawdown anywhere there's pumping, and it can reach to springs. That's all. I didn't really prepare anything to say.
Also, but you're seeing some impacts.
Yes.
Thanks for that.
Jonathan Wade, a question on the approved water system. If the state ends up being more restrictive, future, you know, water increases in a approved water system. What do you think the impact of existing water systems that would need to have more water for growth?
If there are systems that need more water for growth, and we establish a policy that we are not going to approve any more applications, then whatever is approved on the record would be what you would have to use. If you need more water than what's already been approved, then you're going to have to get it from somewhere else. Somebody's going to have to retire. So we couldn't allow any more depletions, or we wouldn't approve anything more because it would cause additional depletions. If we get to the point where we start regulating by priority, even if you're a community water system and you have water rights that are junior rights, they might get cut off. Just say, that's the priority, and you're done with that. You've got to find an additional source. You've got to figure out how to solve that problem. In Cedar City Valley right now, we're looking at some of the cities have some senior rights, but it's like Cedar City itself, a lot of their rights are pretty junior compared to some of the rights, and they're looking at that. Said, uh-oh. What are we going to do? Because they have these future growth projections about how people are moving into the town, and all of a sudden they hit this line. Well, there's the limit of your water. So what are you going to do? So they've made a plan to go to Beaver County and take their water back in. Beaver County was really excited about that. Yes, I say we've been in litigation for several years. We just got that resolved this year about how they're going to share. They figured out a way to do it, but. Yeah, that's problematic, but it is a problem. So do you understand that? I mean, just because a community needs water to grow, we've set a policy that's no more. We're not going to prove anything more.
But then didn't we just say that if somebody wants to come and build and put a well in for their house, that there would be consideration for that?
Okay, the discussion about the individual home wells. Yeah, if they wanted to put in, and that would be how we develop the policy, because seminaries in the state of Utah, you cannot even do that. Cedar City Valley, we will not do that. Okay, Parowan, we won't do that for our enterprise because we're way over using the water that's available, and we have steep declines, a couple of feet per year. We're going down. We've got to get that stabilized. We've got to turn that downward slope and try to get that stabilized. We don't think we're ever going to be able to recover it, but we want to stop this. Go to this, and we're seeing this in Snake Valley, but it's pretty gentle. I mean, in Cedar City, and for enterprise, we're like this. That we're going down here, and it's a trend. And Roy mentioned that we're not seeing we're not seeing seasonal changes of rainfall and stuff. Some of those graphs are just a steady going down. So how many years of steady going down, and even a half a foot per year, can you go down before? Causes some real serious problems. So, and are we there? I don't know if we're there yet, but we may get to a point where we can't even approve home wells. We just say you're going to have to go. What's happening? You're going to have to go to other users to get water. So farms are usually the ones that are diminishing size, and they're selling some of the water out so that people can develop homes. But if we lose all of our agricultural industry in an area that might go build a home. things are coming because the state is so dependent upon our agricultural industry. And I actually had the Commissioner of Agriculture come to me and said, as we're planning to meet water needs for the future of Utah, don't put this on the backs of the farms. Okay? Please don't do that because we need the agricultural industry in the state. We need to keep this economy going. And it's so important, and I agree with that. We need to be very careful. There's just so many issues that have to be considered in this, and trying to do it. So what we need is just local involvement. Again, with people that live here, people that work here, people that have responsibilities for land here, about how are we going to work together to make this work?
Okay. Just a question. Could you see a policy that has the... it would allow a limited amount of domestic water supply system growth with like an overall cap on it. You know, just instead of cutting it off completely, you would just say we'll allow this number of acre feet for domestic systems and then we'll say no after that.
I can see that limit. I'm struggling a little bit because of the numbers we're looking at here.
Yeah.
But I struggle less when I start seeing local problems. We start having problems with wells, between wells, and springs drying out. You know, there might be some areas where we can come back and say, oh, maybe we should only do a little bit more water here, and then we got to live in. Tooele Valley right now, we've had the USGS come in and do a study for us, and we've looked at what we've got a lot of water moving through that valley that feeds the Bear River and the Malad River, and it goes into the Great Salt Lake. And we looked at what's appropriated there, and we're not using anywhere near the amount of water that goes through, but yet we've got some users down at the bottom of the system saying they're not getting their whole water right. and they're protesting everything that happens. So we had this study done. We came back after about 4 years and looked at the results, and we made a determination that we think we can take in that area, in that situation, because of the amount of water, that we said 10,000 acre feet, we think we can develop that, even though we think it's, it might be closer to 100,000 acre feet. It's moving through there. We said 10,000 acre feet, we're going to allow that, and then we're going to let the system stabilize and see what happens to that. And so we set a limit, but that's a higher limit than we would set in most areas, but there's just a lot of water moving through there. But yes, we can set a limit. We can just say an acre foot amount, set that amount, and we're going to stop there. So develop up to that point. And some places we come back and said, let's get real restrictive. We're only going to allow you to do small applications, where we've just established a policy in Rush Valley area, which is in Tooele County, this area south of Tooele, where we've come back and said, there's some pockets of areas in there that we said, someplace, there's just not enough water to do anything. And so we said, but it's remote enough, and so we'll allow homes, but enough for one home and a quarter acre and 10 head of livestock, and you can do that in isolated areas. Another, we've allowed them to go up to an acre in size, but we're not approving any large applications. And we got another area that looks like there's more water available, so we said, well, we'll probably do a little bit more there, but we're going to continue to study it and look at that. But we would set then an acre foot limit on what we think could be approved. So yeah, we can certainly do that, and that might be a good suggestion about what we should do in some of these areas. Okay, any other comments?
Well, I have to admit I'm just a visitor. Well, my name is Jeremy Freeman. I'm just a visitor, but somewhat frequent visitor to your valley here. And I'm wondering if it might be possible to maybe reclaim some water that's not being used to maybe use some water more efficiently. It would be, I understand the divot systems that are so often used in agriculture aren't that efficient. Would it be possible to subsidize the farmers to allow them to use a more efficient method of bringing water to their crop? So, and I emphasize the word subsidize, so you're not putting the financial burden on them, but helping the whole valley out by helping them convert to a more efficient irrigation system. And also, I kind of got a tour up to Hartung, I think, and I was shown a spring that comes out of a mountain with caves on it, and showed me how that spring goes down under the road and takes care of this farm. But in the winter, he said, it goes all the way down, and you can see these salt pools. I don't know if there was water in there now or not. I guess there wasn't. But he said the water that's not used in winter will flood this salty plain, you know, for miles. It's only a few inches deep, and then just evaporate away. Would it be possible to dig this water that you're just letting evaporate away each spring and put it in a tank somewhere and help out the water situation?
And I think all of those things can be considered. Yeah, they certainly can. I know there's an agricultural efficiency committee pulled together, the legislature has actually authorized some funding to kind of look in how agriculture can be more efficient in trying to deliver and distribute their water. There's been some funding and stuff that the legislature has put up to do that kind of thing. So there are some things. I know Cedar City area people are looking at the water that actually had come down through their system and goes out to a couple of lakes, just salty lakes, and it just evaporates off. And they're working on systems now to actually capture that water, put it in recharge basins, and put it back in the groundwater. So that thing that's good. And they've, I can't remember if they've received funding on that, James, or not, to help with that.
Yes, they have.
Yeah, so that, you know, so there are some funding sources to look at those kinds of things that the legislature will put money to kind of help do that for agricultural efficiency purposes. So there, you know, there are some things that can be done like that, but that's a good suggestion. And that's what this Citizens Advisory Group that we pulled together in Cedar City area, that's one of the recommendations that they came up with, is that we want to do this, we want to start putting that water back in, because we don't want to have to cut off homes and city use. We want to put that water back in, and that'll let them go a little bit further into the future to meet their needs by being more efficient with their water. And I think that's the nature of Utah's water use. As we go, as our population grows and the demands on water, we're going to have to be more efficient. But we also need to understand there are just so many different issues that we need to be sensitive about animal species, about people species, and maintaining lifestyles and a limited resource that we're trying to meet all of these demands. I mean, they're talking about the population of the state doubling by 2060, and how are we going to do that? How are we going to do that with the water that we use? In some places, don't even have enough water to get by now. So there's a lot of challenges that we're having to face, and there some of the communities are looking at that now. They're working on recharge projects, but anytime you take the water and do something different with it, something else isn't getting the water that used to get it, and it's not going to be there anymore because the water now is going someplace else. And so they're just impact. Every time we start changing little things, it impacts other areas. And so we have to be very sensitive about what we do there. But good thoughts. I mean, those good thoughts about things that we need to do. Did you have something else there?
Well, I was just going to suggest that it's really kind of you and your staff to come this far to discuss some of these really pressing problems with us. We really do appreciate it. And to express my appreciation in a solid way to you and your staff, I'd invite you, if you ever need to get away for a weekend and see where the stars are still shining and stuff. I've got a whole bunch of jackrabbits that desperately need extermination, and I'd gladly supply a little ammunition.
Gracious offer. Thank you. I do love it out here. I used to be the regional engineer in Mike's position and had the opportunity to come out here quite a bit. And I couldn't ever find a time when I didn't want to spend one more day out here. You know, it's nice. I like it. There's just so many interesting things. I've talked to some people that drive through and they say, oh, that's such a boring drive. I have to go out there. But I said, you need to stop and smell the sagebrush and look at the dirt mounds and see all the geologic parts. There's just incredible things out here. I just really like it. So I'll keep that off in mind. As long as it's not over $50, I think I can accept it. Right? Okay. Any other comments?
Could we just better just
Yes. I'll have to talk about the light's still on, but there's...
Yeah, I think it just...
Unless I just hit a... Yeah. I get the mute button or something. Okay, it was very helpful to have that. So now I'm just going to mouth everything and you try to figure out what I'm saying.
Right. One more question. In basins that you've limited or closed to new agricultural appropriations, how do you typically handle change applications that agricultural operators...
Statute says if you have a water right, you have a right to file a change, to change the point of diversion, the place and nature of use of that water. How we handle it is you have to go through a change application process. That application then would have to be considered on its merits about where the water was and where you want to move and what impacts it's going to have on where you're going to move. We've had a recent Supreme Court decision with Rocky Ford versus Kent's Light that says if you have an underlying water right, you can file a change, and it doesn't matter about the change. You just maintain your underlying priority. And we're not agreeing with that, but we've been reading our response to go to the Supreme Court to please rehear this and don't stick with that stupid decision. But we consider change applications, and I don't know if they will or not. If they don't work, we've actually got some things ready to go to the legislature to pass some new laws so that the Supreme Court can interpret what the laws really should be to reflect current practice. But we are very, very careful with those changes. Everything's approved subject to prior rights. You can't cause impairment. So we'll look at those applications as they try to move, as though they were new corporations in the area. What do we do? We think we can do it without impairing rights. We would approve that application. Again, that's the license to go ahead and see if you can do it without purging something. So that there is a process to go through to do that. And it causes me a little concern out here. We look at, we're only using 20,000, yet we're seeing some problems, but yet there's 90,000 approved in that range, but that's the whole valley too. And that, so if we've got 70,000 acres, we haven't even used yet. These people file changes and want to come into some of these identified critical areas. Would we approve a change to do that, right? Like, that's a real concern. After even the discussion today about, we should probably need to be careful about that. Typically, we'll look at those as to the impact they're going to have on where they're proposing to move that water, what that does, and we'll take into consideration. It's kind of the same process as going through an application to appropriate new battery.
I think we'll give you a couple more minutes.
Okay, a couple more minutes, and well, that's what we got. I figured we'd be done here by. Well, my watch kicked in Nevada time, so I'm like, whatever. Watch way early. So, yeah, well, we got another hour and 10 minutes. Yeah, so I was thinking we'd probably go until about 7 and then be done. But I'm willing to stay here and talk as long as you want to. I do have a meeting in Logan that I have to be to at 8 o'clock in the morning. But other than that, I can go straight there. It's probably going to take me 6 hours. 6 hours drive to Logan from here. So if you give me enough time to get there, I'm happy to stay. The rest of my staff will just leave me here, so I don't know how I'm going to get home. But again, I do appreciate this opportunity to come out here. But you know, let's just make sure we get all the comments and records.
Just one question. Is there any definition around what beneficial use is?
That's a big question.
What is beneficial use? State statute says beneficial use shall be the basis, the measure, and the limit of the rights to use water in the state of Utah. There are no definitions of the total extent of what beneficial use is. Statutes talk about domestic use, municipal use, talks about irrigation, it talks about mining, talks about power, and it talks about a bunch of different uses. There's some talk about recreational use, and there's some talk about different ways to use that. We have to make a determination, is that beneficial use? So we just kind of use that standard. Is this a beneficial purpose? Is there something gained from using the water, either economically or socially, from being able to use the water in a particular way, some benefit to people and to society? And is it in the best public interest? And so we don't have a clear cut. This is the exact list. And we're getting into some fringe areas of beneficial use of what something if people want to do with water. You know, can you have water? How I want water to get an appropriation just to let water flow down the stream, to have an in-stream flow. We can do that in the state of Utah, but you have to be the Division of Wildlife Resources, or you have to be the Division of Parks and Recreation, or you have to be a nonprofit fishery group who could get an appropriation for 10 years to help recover certain species of fish. But those are the only people that can have an in-stream flow right in the state of Utah. Because they see that's a beneficial use, but it's a real restricted beneficial use. So, I have a partial answer for you, which I gave. I don't have a total complete answer.
Could you state your
name? Brent Talbert.
Brent with Materion.
That's all right, too.
Dean Draper. So what will your policy be regarding current applications, change applications, and any possible applications for appropriation in this valley?
Okay, and that policy is going to depend a lot on this discussion and input that we get from you about what we ought to be doing here and those issues that we need to protect here in the valley. I know we've got a lot of pending applications out in the valley right now that have not been approved. I've got to ask myself the question, does it make sense to approve all of those, even though we're having some problems? And so some of that doesn't make sense at all. Typically, if we go into an area and close that area off, we're saying, okay, well, here's the date, we set that policy. Anything filed before that, we will consider under that policy, under the old policy. Anything filed after, it's under the new policy. But we may have a situation here where I can't even do that. We might have things filed already that may not fit where we think we need to go as a community and as water administrators here. So we'll have to work through this process and see where we're going to be.
I'm a little late here, so I hope it's not redundant. What about water that was attached to CITWA lands when they were trying for the Utah-Nevada agreement? CITWA, in particular, sold several sections out here with what appeared to be just paper water, not real stuff. Yet people are assuming that they have a water right that they can quiet that.
Okay, and as far as I know, we had a little bit of discussion about this earlier, but that is, it's really as good as that paper that it's printed on right now. We used a fairly low-grade paper. But I know I've seen some marketing techniques saying that this land comes with water, and I felt concerned about that. We actually have approved some of those based on our policy, taken both small portions and approved that. But we're even asking the question now, should we even be doing that? And so just because things are out there and filed to try to tie up a bunch of water, we had a discussion that maybe that doesn't make sense to have let somebody monopolize all the water that might be available. I don't think that's in public interest. And that's one of the criteria I have to judge applications on. So we're going to look at that. But I'm looking forward to comments that we have received or that we'll receive here tonight and that you're going to send in to us. And as we continue to have these meetings, we'll talk about where we're going to go. And we'll set that policy up and we'll administer it that way. But I have some concern about those applications. They have not been approved. We have somebody asked earlier, why haven't we just rejected them? We just haven't got to those applications yet. We've been trying to establish this policy. So. Okay, any other comments anybody wants to make? What I'd like to do is we've got an address up here on the board. This, if you would like to make comments to us, we'd like to kind of leave November 25th. When's Thanksgiving? 28th. So just before Thanksgiving, as you're getting ready for that. Let's try to have all your comments in for this go-around. Let's get it in there. We're going to consider all the comments by that time. And here's the address that you can send it to us. You certainly, there's an email address if you want to do it that way. Or you can send it by mail. Please put attention Snake Valley Public Meeting. We actually are going to keep a site on our website to keep track of the discussions that we have here. You'll be able to go to our website and actually listen to this meeting. If you forgot something there, just wanted to recall whatever was said. We're going to have that, and we'll actually have the PowerPoint things available on the site that you can look at anything that you might have questions about. And we'll try to post these comments and information that we have come in, and then we're going to consider that, and then we'll come back at some time in the future, and we'll have another gathering. We need to get together, and we'll talk about what we've learned from all of this, and then we're going to keep moving forward until we get to a finalized policy. So we know how best to administer out here. And we really, really are dependent upon the input for those involved locally. It's just so important. And whether you're administering that or whether you live here, you're farming, and you have needs to keep the economy going out here. You know, we want to hear from all of us so we know how to best solve the problems here. So when we see some problems coming, we see some concerning trends, and we need to do what we need to do to protect the futures of everybody out here. So I want to thank you so much for being here this evening and for spending a couple of hours with us. It's been very helpful to me to hear the discussion and hear the concerns. There's a lot of things for us to think about, and I look forward to having your comments come in. We'll review them, we'll give them due consideration, and just appreciate your wanting to be involved. So thank you very much. We will keep in communication with you about anything that we decide or in future meetings. We'll let you know what's happening. We'll continue to work through this. Normally, this doesn't happen in like 2 weeks, okay? So it's going to take a while to work through this, but we will work through it, and we'll continue to be very cautious as we move through this process. So Mike, as far as your area, is there anything else that you would like to address? Or is there anything else? Okay. Thank you so much. We're going to conclude this hearing. Thank you. Not a hearing, but a public meeting. This being a hearing, you know, Teresa left the hearing. Thank